Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Mary, and I'll be hosting today's forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite all students to go next door to our office or to our website at www.hinckley.eutah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is Governing Cooperatively to Solve Problems at the County, City, and State Levels. Today's guest is Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams. Mayor McAdams is a seventh-generation Utahan, a graduate of the University of Utah, a former Hinckley intern, and a graduate of Columbia Law School. He's practiced law school in both New York and Utah. Mayor McAdams served in the Utah State Senate from 2009 to 2012, representing Salt Lake County, South Salt Lake, and West Valley City. He also teaches at the University of Utah College of Law. Mayor McAdams and his wife, Julie, also a Columbia grad, and their four children reside in Salt Lake City, where they enjoy hiking and cheering at their kids' Saturday morning soccer games. Please join me in welcoming Mayor McAdams.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I assume you can hear me all right. There we go. I can talk here. It's great to be here. I think we got it. Sorry about that. Well, it's great to be here. Thank you for welcoming me back to the Hinckley Institute. So I got started in politics some 20 years ago when, first of all, I started as a 17-year-old volunteer on Wayne Owens' U.S. Senate campaign. And I would say, first of all, campaigns are a great way to get involved. But after that, I was less involved until I started here at the University of Utah, and a friend convinced me to take Political Science 101 with Dr. Dan Jones, and so I have Dr. Jones to blame for. I have Dr. Jones to blame for some of for where I am today. And I say blame. My wife says blame. I'll say credit, Dr. Jones. But when I went to law school, I went here to school at the U and did a Hinckley internship in Washington D.C. and then came back and did a Hinckley internship at the Utah State Legislature. Then graduated from the U and moved to New York to go to Columbia Law School. And while I was there, one of my professors, he had held elected office. He had been the Attorney General of Maine. And I told him that I was interested in public service. And his first comment to me was, he looked at me and he said, "Well, Ben, if you're interested in public service, I'm going to give you one piece of advice that will be invaluable to you. It's my advice for you is don't do it." So he said, you know, having done it, I was taken aback. I laughed a little bit, and he said, having been in public service, I'll tell you one thing: it's demanding. It is. You can earn more money doing some other career. You'll have more free time doing something else, and for the most part, people are gonna, you know, you'll have some people who like you, and a lot of people who are mad at you, and you just hope that you got more than 50% liking you than are mad at you. He says, it's a demanding career, and I would sincerely encourage you to look at a different option. And I persisted. I told him that, you know, I really cared about my community. We wanted to move back to Utah and give back. I think we live in such a wonderful place, and I want to be part of helping it to continue to be such a wonderful place to live. Well, he said, okay, well, I'm going to give you a second bit of advice then if you think this is something you really want to do. He said, my advice for you, he said, there are two types of public servants. The first is like a thermometer. A thermometer is a tool that will tell you what the temperature is in the room. And we all can think of politicians who may be a thermometer, who you know maybe what the hot button issue is and where the public is based on what they're saying, what the flavor of the week is that week. And he said there's another type of public servant, and that is a thermostat. A thermostat will change the temperature in the room. If I go over to the thermostat and move it up to 77, the temperature in the room will become 77 degrees. He said, if you were going to make the sacrifices and commitment to give back to the in public service, he said, be a thermostat. Don't just tell people what they want to hear, but lead and help to lead in a positive way to change the temperature in the room. So I thought that was good advice. I came back to Utah after we graduated from I graduated from law school, practiced law for a few years, and then moved back to Utah. And was practicing with a law firm here when I was asked by Mayor Ralph Becker to join. He was elected in 2007, and he asked me to join his team as senior advisor to the mayor. So I left my law practice and started working for Ralph. And one of the first things that came on my plate was Ralph had campaigned on that if elected mayor, he would enact ordinances protecting against discrimination in housing and employment. You can't be fired from your job or evicted from your home because you're gay. And we started working on this, pulled together the attorneys, started crafting these ordinances. I felt that this was something that was fair and reasonable. And over the course of about a year, we went through all the legal mechanics of how this would work and how it would be structured. And so about a year into office, the mayor proposed these ordinances. And no sooner had the mayor proposed, it was actually summer of 2009, so just over a year into office. Summer of 2009, the mayor proposed these ordinances, and no sooner had he proposed them than Senator Chris Butters, a conservative senator, no longer a senator, but a senator from southwest part of Salt Lake County, said that if Salt Lake City proceeds with enacting these ordinances, that he would run legislation to overturn them, to essentially revoke Salt Lake City's ability to do what the mayor had said he was going to do. And city governments, we derive our authority, local governments, we derive our authority from the state. It's only to the extent granted to us by the state. So he had the ability to do that. Salt Lake City, being a more progressive city, has a history of playing ping pong with the legislature, where Salt Lake City will propose something, the legislature will overturn it, Salt Lake City will propose it, legislature overturns it. So it was nothing new. But this was a particularly sensitive time in the community where it was 6 months after Proposition 8. The community was, there was a lot of tension in the community. The community is being torn apart. And I went to the mayor as a Mormon Democrat and said, hey, I find myself on both sides of this issue, and there's got to be a better way to do this than to just one side win and the other side lose in a battle. We've got to find a better way. And I asked the mayor, I said, I know that these are set to be adopted in the near future. Will you give me a month to see if I can build some support around it before we just go down this path of the city adopting it, the legislature overturning it, and bring in a national spotlight, negative national spotlight into Utah that would hurt our tourism, hurt our ability to recruit businesses. We were actually in conversations at the time with companies like Goldman Sachs that is now here, Adobe that's now here. It's going to hurt our ability to attract these businesses and others. And he said, okay, how about a month? So first thing I did was called Senator Butters, and I said, can I come and meet with you to talk about ordinances against discrimination? He said, oh, I know what those are, and you're not going to change my mind. I said, well, why don't we talk? So I went to his house, sat in his living room, and we sat for 2 hours as we talked about why I believed on a personal level that these were important protections, why these ordinances were important, why I wanted to live in a community where my neighbors and my coworkers had access to basic human liberties and rights, like a right to a job and a right to housing. And he said, well, you've made some good points. At the end of 2 hours, you've made some good points. I'm still not persuaded. So from there, I started meeting with other legislators throughout the state, traveling. I felt it was important. Sometimes Salt Lake City gets a bad rap as thinking it's the center of the world. So we made a point, and the mayor and I, in many cases, traveled to local diners throughout Utah to meet with legislators in their home district and talk to them about why we felt this was important. 1 month became 2 months, became 3 months, and I kept going back to the mayor saying, we're making progress on this. I think we're going to be able to have a win. I need another month. When Salt Lake City adopted these protections in November of 2009, Senator Butters supported them. The LDS Church was the first to testify in support of these ordinances, and Salt Lake City had a historic win. Far from the legislature overturning them, I was shortly thereafter elected to the state Senate, and have sponsored legislation to take these ordinances and apply them on a statewide level. Now, statewide non-discrimination, my legislation hasn't passed yet, but as of now, 16 cities throughout Utah have adopted these ordinances word for word. Some of them, you know, Salt Lake City wasn't too much of a surprise because Salt Lake City is a little bit progressive. But when we saw cities like West Valley and Taylorsville and Logan adopting them, and other cities that we're talking to in conservative areas of the state adopting these protections, it really is significant. I was elected last year as mayor of Salt Lake County, so no longer have the privilege of serving in the state senate. But I was elected last year. There was a poll done, my last legislative session, a poll done showing that over 70% of the people of Utah support these protections. And I had a Republican co-sponsor for the first time for my legislation. This year, I left the Senate, so I was no longer running that legislation, and it was picked up by one of my Republican senators. So it truly is now a bipartisan effort. It has not passed. Still has some, I think, some kinks to work through and need to garner some support, but momentum is growing on this. So the temperature in the room on non-discrimination has changed in the last 5 years. And, you know, it's not just me, and I'm honored to have had a part in it and to have been able to carry the legislation, but there's been a lot of people who have involved in this conversation. And far from where we saw this in the beginning was a divisive conversation where we were seeing protests at the temple and we were seeing the community torn apart. We've seen over the last 5 years a healing dialogue where people have come together, and the conversation in Utah has been focused not on what we disagree on. There certainly are still disagreements, but it's a conversation on what can we find to agree on. And this has been a significant area of common ground where people have come together, where we've recognized, given recognition to people who are different and their right to have a job and housing, and we've given recognition to religious liberties and the need to respect people's faith and how they exercise that faith, and we've been able to find common ground. And I think that for me it's been such a privilege to be part of that conversation, because I think it's shown where we can take a very difficult topic, and just sitting down and talking, we can find areas of common ground. And if we're willing to work on those areas of common ground, we can move forward. We've been able to a large extent drain the poison out of that dialogue and make it a constructive, positive conversation. So I think that's talking about working together at the local level, at the state level, working across party lines. That's an example that I frequently think of, and it's been really has been, I think, an honor to be a part of that. And I've come to respect my colleagues from the other side of the aisle for their willingness to open themselves up, tell me what their concerns are, and then once I gain their trust that I'm not going to go out and burn them and torch them in the media. They're willing to tell me what their concerns are, and usually when I understand their concerns, we're able to work through them and find ways to address those in the legislation. But it does take a certain degree of trust, and that takes time to build that trust and work to build that trust. And it, you know, I think my success on the topic of non-discrimination has been helped by my ability to sit down on other issues and to build that relationship and that friendship where we may disagree, but we go out to dinner after we disagree and we meet for breakfast and talk about another issue that's important to them, and I'm willing to listen and to build that trust. And that trust has helped me now that I've been elected county mayor and moved off the Hill to have relationships that I can rely on as we tackle some very difficult situations. And there are difficult situations that we're encountering now. I, as the mayor of Salt Lake County, have jurisdiction from Salt Lake City on the north to Harriman, Bluffdale on the south. It's 1.1 million people in Salt Lake County. Salt Lake County is facing some very difficult challenges as well. We have a population today that is about 1.1 million, and they tell us within the next 20 to 30 years, our population will double. So that is going to place a lot of strains on what we look like and what we look like as a valley. When I think about my wife and I, when we were practicing law in New York and decided our twins were born, we had twins in 2005 and decided that we wanted to raise our family back home in Utah. So when the twins were born, we moved back home, and I think about what brought us back home, and it's that certainly family was here, but it's also that this is such a wonderful community where it's a great place to raise kids. It's a great place to have a family. We have good schools, you know, good opportunities for outdoor recreation. The people are nice and friendly. Your neighbors are, our neighbors are generally friendly. It's a wonderful place to live and to raise a family. And that's what I love about Utah, and I think what brought us back when our kids were born, our twins were born in 2005. So as our population doubles over the course of the next 20 years and just grows dramatically, that population growth can change who we are. We can harness it, and it can be a very positive influence for and a positive energy for our economy, for our schools, for our the way we grow, the way we develop. It can be a very positive thing, or it can change us for the negative. We can lose that small town feel that we enjoy today. So I think the challenge in front of us, as residents of Salt Lake County, and I'll even broaden that as residents of the Wasatch Front, is as we've evolved over the last 20 years, that 20 years ago, we were a sea of farmland and open space, and you had some islands dotted throughout it, you know, and you may not remember that time when we were what we were like even 20, 30 years ago, but think as you drive down State Street and you hit Murray and you see kind of that small town Murray. Imagine, take yourself back even 20 years ago about what Murray looked like. Now we've got cities that have grown together. We're not a sea of farmland and open space. We're a sea of population and populated areas. And the islands in today are islands of open space. And we're losing that open space quickly. So we have changed dramatically in the last 20 years. We will change even more rapidly, exponentially in the next 20. So the challenge for Salt Lake County is to be a thriving metropolitan area, to bring jobs and have a thriving economy and tourism industry and the exciting things, the exciting opportunities and positives of being a metropolitan area. It's to maintain that. I think we have it today, but to maintain it and expound upon that thriving metropolitan area. But at the same time, I think the challenge is to maintain the small town feel that we enjoy today. So we want to have a thriving metropolitan area with a small town feel. That's not easy, and only by collaborating across party lines, by collaborating between county government, reaching down and working with city government. One of the challenges we have in Salt Lake County, I said, so we have jurisdiction over a county population of 1.1 million people. So Salt Lake County government is the largest government in the state of Utah, second only to the state itself. But also in Salt Lake County, we have 16 cities. I mentioned some of them: Salt Lake City, South Salt Lake, Harriman, Bluffdale, Sandy City, West Valley, Holiday. 16 cities throughout Salt Lake County. So there's some challenges there that how we grow and develop has to be. And so the county has no hierarchical authority over those cities. They don't answer to me. I don't answer to them. We are different layers of government with no legal ties to each other. So as we look at what this county's looking like, some of the issues we're facing are transportation. It's growing. It's how we grow. Do we grow density? Do we have transit lines? Do we use those transit lines to grow and bring population in around transit so we can have transit-oriented development that helps people to get away from their cars and reduce our air pollution? So all of these challenges we face are ones that are collective challenges, but our problem-solving bodies are all, we have 16 individual problem-solving bodies with a collective problem. So how do we address a collective problem? It has to be by working collectively. And there's no legal hooks or, you know, no, we can't bind them. We have to work collaboratively with these cities to develop a growth plan and move forward and implement plans for growth that really do grow a transportation system in a sustainable fashion, help to bring our communities into sustainability with our environment and our air quality and our airshed. It's looking at the development of the canyons and how do we use those canyons in a way where there's going to be increasing pressures of development on those canyons. How do we conserve those for future generations, for the continued use, the hiking and outdoor uses that I love and brought us, one of the things that brought us back to Utah are those outdoor opportunities that we have. And I'll tell you, it's a challenge. And it's only by working collaboratively that we're going to be able to rise to those challenges. And the state has to be part of those solutions. Capital County, 40% of our state's population. It's only the state does care about the economy and the air quality and the transportation systems in Salt Lake County. So there is a need greater than ever before for our state government to work with our county government, to work with 16 city governments to address the challenges we face. And that's, I've been county mayor now for 3 months, almost 3 months, not quite 3 months, but almost 3 months. And that's the situation we've inherited, is one where we have incredible assets. A county government that's generally well-managed, things are operating well on the inside, but enormous challenges on our horizon. How are we going to, grab the reins and to use that energy of the changes that are coming to our region, harness that energy and channel it into positive positive developments, or are we going to just sit back and allow it to change us? And I worry if we allow it to change us, we're not going to like the outcome. So that's where we are today, and it's, you know, I feel fortunate to have strong relationships still in the legislature, and it's not easy as a Democrat in the legislature. Sometimes my job and the reason that I was elected was to be a voice of opposition and to give a differing opinion and stand for and take a different stand on issues than some of my Republican colleagues. And I understand that's an important part of my job, but the challenge has been to do that in a way that I don't destroy that long-term trust that I've built up, where I can go and sit down and say, okay, so I know we just had an argument in the press about this. I need your help on developing transportation systems in Salt Lake County, and we can all agree that that's important, and we sit down and work on it. And that's one of the challenges, and it's I think we can do that, and that's one of the things that works well in Utah. Unlike Washington, D.C., I think I'm frustrated with Washington, D.C., as I'm sure many others are, where it seems like nothing gets done. The partisan divide and who's going to win the next election takes precedence over how are we going to solve the problems of today. And I think Utah's different, candidly. I think we do sit down. We do try to work through our problems. We talk to each other, and we are able to move forward. Not always, but generally speaking, I'm pleased with how we're able to put partisan differences aside and work toward our greater good. So with that, happy to keep talking, but I'd love to answer any questions you might have and thoughts you might have on Salt Lake County. Yeah.
Hold on. If you have a question, just speak into the mic and say your name and something about yourself.
My name is Tyler Calder. I'm an econ major, and I just had a question. What kind of options have you been, or has the county government been thinking about as it prepares for the doubling of the population?
So there's some good things happening. We have some good plans. About 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, we received a grant. We partnered with the Wasatch Front Regional Planner, Wasatch Front Regional Council, a metropolitan planning organization that covers Salt Lake, Davis, and Weber County, where we plan transportation infrastructure. We have a world-renowned world-renowned entity in Envision Utah that's looked at how we grow and what our growth should look like, and we have some great ideas. We've developed what we call Wasatch 2040. What our community looks like in the year 2040, and what transportation infrastructure do we need to have in place in order to maintain that community, to have that community be what we want it to be. So we have Wasatch 2040 that lays out that map, and it's a very good plan. It was developed, and we had all 16 cities at the table, the county at the table, and we've developed some of those. You know, where do we need some additional roads? But it's not just about building roads, because when you build roads, a lot of times that brings more cars, that brings more air pollution. So it's roads, but it's also where do we need more transit? Where do we need more bus lines? Where do we need bus rapid transit is kind of the next frontier in the development of our transit network, where these are buses that have dedicated bus lanes, so they're fast, they're cheaper than a tracks line, but and serve a different function than a tracks line, but a bus rapid transit, where do we develop bus rapid transit? And then coupled with that, there needs to be a housing development. You know, building transit lines need to be coupled with how do we grow, where do we have density, where do we have, you know, where do we have larger subdivisions with larger lots, and where do we have density that are walkable communities that are near a transit line, and how do you help families maybe only own one car instead of two? So that's, we have Wasatch 2040 that I think is that roadmap. It is where we want to go. I guess literally a roadmap, but also figuratively a roadmap of where we want to go and how we're going to get there. I think the next challenge is, though, how do we get there? That's going to cost money. And we don't have the money right now. So it's going to be, where do we find the funding to implement these transit systems? Now, nobody else, the private sector is not going to build roads, and the private sector is not going to build bus rapid transit, so it is a function of government. So how are we going to do that? Where's the funding going to come from is an important topic. And then how do we do it? You know, they also got this tension among 16 cities in the county of, well, we all buy into Wasatch 2040, let's do it in my city first, where it may be more important to do it somewhere else. So how do we implement that for the collective benefit rather than the individual benefit of the jurisdictions throughout the county? So there's still challenges in implementing Wasatch 2040. Funding is the first one. And we've had some conversations with the legislature about how we derive some of that funding. I do believe that it would be unfair to call it an expense. I think it's an investment, because to bring the next eBay, that's a good example. We just partnered with the city of Draper, Salt Lake County, and the school district, the Canyon School District, to make an investment in developing. eBay's come in, and they need some additional public infrastructure, some roadways and different things there to develop the eBay site. So the eBay can expand, and we can start to develop a technology corridor there from eBay down to Adobe. And so we've made that investment in Draper. So there are conversations like that. It's not going to, like I said, it's not going to be easy. We do need far more funding than even we've committed right now to Draper. And that needs to be a topic in the next couple years that we decide. Otherwise, you're going to see some of these needs met. You're going to see congested roadways. You're going to see housing's going to develop. Population's growing. The housing's going to develop. Is it the type of housing that will help to preserve our community, to help to clean our air, to have schools that are sustainable? You know, one of the it's really actually really interesting stuff that we're talking about, cutting edge stuff. But we're talking about, for example, aging in place. You look at some of the communities that the models of development from the 1940s and 50s as America really started to grow. You have communities where today, you know, I think of my hometown that born and raised in West Bountiful, Utah. Today that population is much older, and you start closing down schools. So we build a school that is an expensive investment, but only lasts 20 years before the kids are born and raised and moved out, and we don't have a population to sustain the school. So we're closing schools, and think of the waste of taxpayer dollars as we close a school. This notion of aging in place, where you build communities that have houses for young families, houses for more mature families, houses for empty nesters and elderly, and they can all still live in the same community. So you have a school population that doesn't swell and then disappear, and you're discarding schools and you're wondering what you do with this open space. And you have, you know, in the case of my mother, living in, you know, we didn't have a huge house, but a 2,000 square foot house with a yard that's difficult to maintain. And is that the best, you know, she doesn't want to leave her neighborhood. But if she had an option where she could maybe move into a condo and stay in the same neighborhood, I think she'd take it. So better land use, as land becomes a precious resource and a limited resource, we can use land better through this concept of aging in place. The communities, you may be building schools to last for 50 years because we know we're going to have turnover, a constant turnover and a stable population for the school. So that investment isn't wasted, so that land is used appropriately, so that we have sustainable communities that are really built for the long term. And that's kind of the principles we're trying to apply today. But how do we do that with 16 different ideas of how to do that is the challenge. And it's one that we don't have a solution necessarily for today, other than persuading and and hoping. You know, I think hoping that we all kind of sing on the same sheet of music. You've seen, you've all probably in college talked about the prisoner's dilemma and I think what we've got here is a prisoner's dilemma, that it probably is better for one city to leave and do their own thing. That's in the interest maybe of one city to the detriment of 15. But if we want to do something that is in the benefit of all 16, we need people to stay at the table and to coordinate. And that's one of our challenges right now in the metropolitan area we live in, where we live in cities that have grown together and blended to a large extent. Do you have a question? Yes.
I'm Olivia Shaughnessy. I'm a political science major here. And I was wondering if you could go into some more detail about what you think are the problems with our education system and what you think is important as a county mayor to do about that.
I talk about some problems with our education system. I talk about our population doubling in the next 20 years. That's only the tip of the iceberg. The demographic makeup of our population is changing even more rapidly than that. Just to illustrate, I'm not going to get the numbers exactly right, but they told me the other day that our aging population will quadruple in the next 10 years. So a doubling in 20 overall, but quadrupling of our aging population in 10. So, you know, retired population. I guess we're all aging, right? So, but a retired population will double in the next 10 years, or quadruple in the next 10 years. Our population is becoming increasingly ethnically diverse. And I think that's a blessing. I think that makes this such an interesting community. As county mayor, travel to, you know, and meet with the Vietnamese community and the Hispanic community and see the rich cultural heritage we have in this community and the refugees who we welcome in. During the campaign, I had the opportunity to meet on several occasions with the Somali Bantu community and at the mosque down on 33rd South. And just, we have such a rich cultural fabric in this community it continues to grow as we welcome immigrants into our community, we're one of 10 refugee receiving centers throughout the United States, and that's changing our community. And I think it's changing our community for the better. It's bringing a richness to our community. But I don't know that we're not giving our schools the resources to keep up with those changes. We've been able to skate by for the last so many years with a lower funding on average for per pupil funding on average, because to a large extent we could have a cookie cutter approach to education that one size fits all worked to some extent in our education system. We're not there anymore. One size doesn't fit all. We have kids who learn different ways, come from different family backgrounds, different support networks at home, and one size does not fit all. And what's happening is if we continue to apply the one size fits all model, you see an achievement gap. That one size fits some, and the rest are falling behind. And when those kids fall behind, we see, you know, they drop out of school. We're seeing high school dropout going up. We're seeing college enrollment in our ethnic communities is not good. We're seeing, you know, those kids don't go on to, many of those kids don't go on to earning a livable wage. Or in some cases when they drop out, you see gang activity and crime. And all of those have government costs. You know, it's not like by skimping on our education system, we have a lower overall budget. It means we may pay less for education, but our police and our other government costs are going up. So the first, I think, challenge with our education system is funding. I think our school systems got by with very little funding for a long time and done a marvelous job with it. But we're starting to see signs of stress, and that will change. And we need to support our schools. Funding needs to be part of the solution. Now, I can sympathize with some of my colleagues who are hesitant to increase education funding. I say empathize. I don't know that I sympathize, but I do believe I have been an advocate for increasing school funding and have run legislation on it. Some of the frustration from some of my colleagues, one of the things I always try to do is put myself in their shoes and try and see it from their point of view, because I think that not necessarily do I agree, but it helps me to understand the picture. There's frustration. If we increase, you know, if we reduce class sizes from 33 kids to 32 kids in a classroom, is our school system better off? And it's costs so much money to do that that we want to know that if we're putting money into, you know, if we're putting money into our school system, we're getting a return on that investment. And I can share the frustration. My twins are now in first grade, and I think they have 25 kids in their class, and it's a large class, and that they're, you know, in our neighborhood school, and that worries us. And but I don't know that reducing the class size to 24 is going to make that any better. So where do we with, and I don't think we can generate the type of money to, you know, they tell us that we should be 1 to 12, one teacher to 12 kids in a classroom would be ideal for, is what the studies say. To get there, we can't do that. We can't raise taxes high enough to get to a 1 to 12 ratio. So I think that's where innovative thinking comes in. And maybe that's been the breakdown in the past is one side says, we can't afford what we need, so let's not do anything. And the other side says, well, here's what we need, and we got to do something. And I don't feel like we've had great solutions in the middle to say, well, we can't afford to get it down to 1 to 12, but what about preschool? And preschool, if we can get those at-risk kids who are falling through the cracks, through the achievement gap, and get them, we can afford preschool in the state for at-risk youth. And if they get into school speaking English fluently and knowing their alphabet and colors and starting to read at age 4 and 5, if we can fund preschool, then we can, studies show that they will start on equal footing and they'll keep up and we can eliminate the achievement gap just with preschool. It's not going to solve all of our ailments in education, but it's a step that we can afford. And so we've seen conversations recently start focusing on what can we do and what can we afford, and I think that's some of the solution. There was legislation this last session about funding preschool that failed. It was disappointing to see it fail. And it failed for other reasons. I don't know how close you followed it, but the Eagle Forum is concerned that preschool takes kids out of the home and away from the family, and so we should not fund preschool. Look on your face is similar to, I can sympathize. It was disappointing because I think it also does not reflect the reality that I see as I go out into these schools. And last week was visiting the Boys and Girls Club and seeing what great things they're doing in after-school programs to help some of these kids. And it makes a difference in the lives of these kids. And it's not the question of being at home in a two-parent household reading with your mother in preschool. It's, you know, these families are different and our communities are changing and we need to help these kids. We need to help these kids compete in a tough world. And preschool is part of that. After-school programs are part of that. And we need more of those, and we can't afford those. So that's maybe some of the solutions is if we're not going to be able to immediately get our class sizes down to 12, let's focus on the hot-button solutions that do work, like preschool and after-school programs and reading programs and enhancing our science, technology, learning in the classrooms. So that's, I think, maybe some of the solutions for education. Yes.
Hi, my name is Rochelle Roberts. I'm a biology and political science major. And you've mentioned funding a couple times, both with education and transportation and obviously with lots of other issues. Where do we get the money? Where do we find more funding? Obviously, it's something we need. We know that the federal government is having a lot of problems, obviously, with funding and sequestration, everything like that. So as a state and as a county, how do we help the situation on a local level?
Great question. That's never a question politicians like to answer. So, but we have to. That's right. And that's part of the solution. The challenge, I think, that's part of the challenge is funding is taxes. And you know, I'm as sensitive as the next person to we need to keep taxes low. Part of the funding, I guess, is when Adobe comes in and eBay comes in and they hire 2,000 people each, and Goldman Sachs hires 2,000 people. They're paying income tax. We didn't raise taxes, but our tax base grew. So I think the first place we're going to look is growing our tax base. And when I say, you know, we've got our population growth and the way Salt Lake County is changing is our biggest challenge, I think it's also our biggest opportunity because We will see new houses that will be built, and without raising taxes, we're going to see new taxpayers who will pay more into the school system and to build our roads. We're going to see new cars on the road that will be consuming gas tax and paying to help build our roads. So we're in a time of growth where there will be new revenue just with growth. And you know, part of it, I think the first place we look is to grow our tax base by bringing in, growing this technology corridor from eBay to Adobe, and who else comes in there. And we see a lot of people, a lot of companies looking to move out of California because of challenges in California. If we can land them here in Utah, that's the first opportunity for growing school funding and growing our transportation funding. Beyond that, though, we have a tax system in Utah that is very conservative, and I'll say I support it. I consider myself a fiscal conservative, and on tax issues, on tax and finance issues, frequently agreed with my Republican colleagues on, or I should, maybe I should say they agreed with me. So, I in order to continue to attract the next eBay and Adobe, we need to have a competitive tax structure. So we should be very hesitant to go to looking to raise taxes to generate revenue. But at the same time, if we don't have roads and we don't have a good education system, Adobe's not going to come either. So it's kind of got to be in balance that we have competitive tax structure, a quality education system, and a transportation network that maintains a healthy balance in the valley. So growing the tax base. Starting to talk about our tax structure. We have a tax structure in Utah that's set up from the get-go to have downward pressure on government revenues. So, for example, county government is funded primarily through sales tax and property tax. Sales tax has inflation built into it because sales tax is 6.75%, 6.85%. And if the cost of a candy bar today goes up, and the cost of a gallon of milk today and increases 10% next year, then sales tax will naturally follow that increase because it's on, you know, how much per dollar we spend. So sales tax has inflation built into it. In many other states, you see other tax revenues having inflation built into it. In Utah, we've taken inflation out of that. So say property tax. And like I said, I support it. I think it's good. I think I, as government, should have downward pressure based on my revenue, and that if I ever need more revenue, I should have to ask for it. I shouldn't just get it because of inflation. Because I guess the premise is, does the size of government need to inflate as CPI grows? And I don't think that's the case. I think we should always say government, we should try to keep government the same size as our economy grows, not grow government as our economy grows, is the premise. Unless I come back and ask you for it and make the case and stand to the voters and say, here's what I need and here's why I've done it, and make the case and I'm accountable to the voters. I think that's healthy in a democracy to not just have windfalls for government in our coffers. So property tax, what we did with property tax, and in a lot of places in which you'd intuitively think of property tax, say my property tax is 1%. And so my home value increases by 3% from 1 year to the next. So property tax would increase by 3% from 1 year to the next. Well, we actually, 15 years ago, went and redid that. So what we said is, I, as the county mayor, I look and we have $1 billion. It's not even close to being accurate, but just for simplicity's sake, $1 billion worth of property value throughout Salt Lake County. And our property tax is 1%, so that gets me $10 million in property tax, right? And so next year, if property values increase by 10%, so we have $1.1 billion of value, what we do is, instead of saying my property tax is 1%, so I get $10 million, so now I'd get $11 million because property increased, we said what I get is $10 million. So if the properties, if so you have, in your, I know I'm not speaking to math majors here, I don't think, at least, but so you've got the value of property multiplied by the tax rate equals the tax revenue for government. So we switch that around, and so what is changes is, as value increase, if the rate stays fixed, value increases, then the revenue to government will increase. We've changed that around, and we've said, actually, what we're going to do is we're going to peg the revenue to government so it stays fixed. So as property values decrease, we know that I got $10 million last year, I'm going to get $10 million this year. So as the values increase by 10%, the tax rate will go from a 1% tax rate to a 0.9% tax rate. So I still get $10 million. I don't get an additional $1 million that I get to go and decide where to spend. So we have that. There's no inflation in property tax, which I think is healthy, and downward pressure. But it means that from time to time, your government leaders are going to come to you and ask for a tax increase. And it's, in many cases, it's not a tax increase. It's just adjusting for inflation because cost of gas has gone up, and the cost of putting gas in our fire trucks and our police trucks has gone up. The cost of providing health insurance to our employees who are out cutting the grass in the parks, and the cost of wages has gone up. So from time to time, we're going to need to come to you. It's built into the system that we're going to need to come to you and say, hey, we can no longer afford to put gas in the police cars unless we raise taxes. And we're actually raising taxes less than inflation, but it's built that we would come and ask you for tax increases from time to time. That's a painful thing to do, and a lot of times it doesn't happen. What you've seen a lot of times since we instituted this 15 years ago is people don't have courage to come and say, we need more money to put gas is quadrupled, we need to put gas in the police cars. So what they do instead is they say, well, we need to put gas in the police cars, so instead of fixing the sprinkler system in the park, we're going to put gas in the police cars. Sprinkling system breaks, the grass in the park dies, and the park's no longer usable. And you know, and then you got to resod and put grass in a park, and that's expensive. And so it's a delicate balance, but you'll see from time to time your mayors and other political leaders coming to you and asking for a tax increase, and in many cases it's just adjusting for inflation, but maybe that's part of it. So the gas tax is the same way. The gas tax, constitutionally, gas funds transportation, and income tax funds schools. So gas tax, we have gas is per gallon, not per dollar. So if we had gas, if you paid tax on your gasoline and it was based on the dollar, then you'd see as the price of gas quadrupled, the revenue for transportation would quadruple, right? But instead we put it on the gallon. So your car, you know, your car has a 20-gallon tank, and it may cost you, 5 years ago, it may have cost you $20 to fill your tank. Today it costs you $40 to fill your tank. The revenue that's going to transportation is the same because it's you still got a 10-gallon tank, and so you're still sending the same amount to government. But actually what you've seen is it doesn't increase for inflation. And to the contrary, cars have gotten more fuel efficient. So the wear and tear, the miles you drive on a road, the wear and tear you put on a road increases, and the revenue from the gas tax decreases. So you have fuel efficient cars. You have hybrids now that are driving 40 miles to the gallon instead of 15 miles to the gallon. And so transportation has been a dwindling revenue source, and we haven't seen an increase in the gas tax since 1997. So there's been significant inflation, and the CPI's increased, and the cost of building a road, or the cost of filling potholes because of the cost of providing health insurance and salaries and materials and all of that, that's increased since 1997, but the revenue's actually gone down. So we see this gap in transportation. So there's been a conversation of maybe adjusting the gas tax to account for inflation, and that would help to fund some of the Wasatch 2040 proposals of transportation infrastructure. And then education, we've spent less and less on education. We've actually, if you look at what we spent on transportation, transportation's taken a hit over the last 15 years, but as government revenues have been strained, we've actually pulled it out of education to try and keep transportation afloat. So education has really taken a hit over the last 15 years. One of the metrics that we use is effort. How much, it's maybe not per pupil. In Utah, we say per pupil funding is hard to measure because we have so many kids per tax earner that our per pupil funding's low. But how much does the taxpayer give to education? And that's actually gone down. That when I graduated from high school, we were, I think, 10th in the nation for taxpayer effort to supporting schools, and now we're 45th or something around there, 45th in the nation for taxpayer effort. So we're trying less. I think there's this mentality that, we can't reduce schools to 1 in 12, one teacher per 12 kids, so why try? And what you've seen is we are now 51st in the nation for per pupil funding, and we're 51st by a lot. We're 51st by, I knew this number because I ran a bill on it a couple years ago, but I think we're 51st by about 150 million behind number 50. So we're falling further and further behind. And I think we need to start looking at effort. We may not get to number one, but I'd be happy right now to be number 50 and to close that gap. Because when we say we're 51st, and that's just the way it is, and there's nothing we can do about it, then all of a sudden we're 51st by 100 million, by 200 million, and we keep falling. And so we're really at a crisis level, I think, in education funding.
Hi. First, my name is Carter Folger. I'm a poli-sci student here at the U. I voted for you, and
thank you.
I voted for you because of your support for equal rights and whatnot in you know, housing and employment. So thank you. First. Second, in your first term here, what do you think is the most important thing that you're going to be dealing with? I know you've talked a lot about long-term stuff, but short-term.
Short-term is, I do think some of the long-term stuff I'm talking about, those are manifesting themselves in the short-term. That if we don't get serious about schools and transportation in the short-term, it's not a long-term solution. It's a short-term solution that may be to address a long-term problem. So first, I think that is one of the challenges. I think the biggest thing we're probably dealing with is the fact that I think who we are as a community, as a region, what our county looks like has changed so dramatically over the last 50 years that our government structures need to play catch-up. So we're seeing a lot of changes as how the county interacts with cities, how the county interacts with the state. So some of it's updating. And for example, talk about how, 20 years ago we were these islands of urban populations that were distinct from each other. And you had each city had its own public works department that would plow the streets and provide animal control. Well, as now we've grown together and as you drive throughout the valley, you don't know when you've left one city and entered another. We still have snow plows that are driving down the street, lifting up their plow halfway down because they've entered another city. They drive half a block and then put their plow down again and plow the rest of the street. So that didn't happen 20 years ago because you didn't have city growing up against city. Now today it happens, and we've got to, I think, update our government structures to reflect that. So that's one of the things we're working on. Certainly, we're coming out of the Great Recession, so we've had to make tough choices as the county in the past of how to balance our budget. And I talk about we have sprinkler systems that haven't been maintained and the grass is dying. How do we now? And I think during that time it was a tough decision. We had no good options. It was probably the least bad option, is to maintain what we could and provide this level of services, but we had to let something slip. But today, we've got to fix those sprinkling systems, and we've got to invest in the deferred maintenance and the decaying maintenance that we have, and I think get caught up on that. And so we have some strains in the budget. Budgets are going to be a challenge in the next few years. We continue to see healthcare costs grow and price of fuel and energy grow. They tell us that our expenses in county government are growing at about 3% a year. The economy's coming back, and we're happy about that, but our revenues through sales tax are growing at 1% a year. So we have a balance, we have a budget that's a bit on a collision course, that expenses are growing faster than revenue, and unless we can get that under control, we're going to look at another tax increase. And, nobody likes tax increases. So that's a challenge. And, like I said, it would be still, if it were a tax increase, it would be an adjustment for inflation, because inflation is about 3% a year, but our revenues are right now only growing at 1% a year. So I don't know if that makes sense. There are quite a few challenges, not necessarily a lot of them aren't headline grabbers, but it's all the things we're talking about. I think it's our school system, it's our transportation networks, public safety, and what our county is going to look like in 20 years, but it's laying the groundwork today for what we want it to look like in 20 years. Yeah.
Hi, Joel Johnson, political science major here. On this anti-discrimination legislation that you mentioned, I think Urquhart ran it this year and made it through committee, which is, I believe, the farthest it's ever been.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, what do you think will have to happen in the legislature? Will there need to be change in leadership, or what dynamic will have to change for that to pass completely through the body?
You know, Urquhart was a champion this year. He was great. He's one who I have a great relationship with, Urquhart, someone I really respect and admire. And I'll tell you, it was scary for him to take that bill. You wouldn't know it by what he said, but you have to worry about what your constituents are going to think, what your delegates are going to think. And he took that bill and ran with it and did an excellent job. And he came and told me, you know, I thanked him for running it. And he said, you know, I go to church on Sunday and people come up to me and say, thank you. He's like, I am not getting criticized by anybody. People are saying, we're proud of the work you're doing. Keep it up. So that's the non-discrimination bill, the one for housing and employment, the one that I ran for several years. So Senator Urquhart took it on and ran it this year and said that people at church are complimenting him on it. He wrote an op-ed in the paper saying why he was doing it. And, you know, there was opposition in the Senate for sure. The support is maybe deeper than... I ran it last year and we got it into committee, which was a success. And it's a little bit sad that we're calling letting it die in its first public hearing was a success, but the couple of years that I'd ran it before that, it was not let out for a public hearing. So getting it into a committee was a success. Urquhart passing it out of committee, which meant that you don't get, you know, just based on the numbers, the Senate is 80% Republican, 20% Democrat. Clearly, there was more than Urquhart that supported it. I think he had 3 Republican votes to move it forward and to the Senate floor. There are more legislators out there who support it in the House and the Senate. I've had many Republicans in the House come up to me and say, if it ever comes to the House, I'm voting for it. So I think it'll pass in the next few years. I think you've got leadership in both houses that are willing to let it move forward. We didn't have that in the past. I think there's just probably a greater conversation about just some additional politics and maybe some policy that has to be worked out in it. And I know they're working on it. I am, even though I was running for county mayor last year, spent a lot of time working on, knowing that somebody else was going to eventually run the bill, did spend a lot of time working with the stakeholders and finessing the bill. And it's pretty close. I think it passes soon. And the other thing that's exciting is what you see is, I said 16 cities throughout Utah have adopted it. In the last few months, Boise adopted it. I think it was Idaho Falls adopted it, and Phoenix adopted it. So you're starting to see this as really a tool to find consensus. And in conservative states, it's a way of draining the poison out of the dialogue and finding common ground. And so it's continues to have success, and I think it's only a matter of a few short years before we see it adopted in Utah.
This concludes today's radio broadcast. Please join me in thanking Mayor McAdams.